When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, editor at the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Anthony Valerio and Michael Piekny about Anthony's new book, Confessions of an Aspiring Pornographer. This book is the first publication of the new publisher, Grayling Press, of which Michael is the founder. I'm excited today to discuss both Anthony's new book and what it takes to launch a new literary publisher in 2024. Confessions is a portrait of a charming rogue, Walter Michael Gregory, or simply Wally, as he navigates 20th century New York City. Anthony writes with a skill honed over decades, and I'm grateful to have this conversation with him and Michael. Thank you both for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Yeah, thank you, Caleb. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you, Caleb. I'm excited and very pleased to be here with you and Michael regarding talking about this book a little.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on New Books Network, Anthony, and it's great to meet you, Michael. It's always interesting, I think, to talk about these sorts of novels, especially ones where there's clearly so much that you put into this, Anthony. I'm sure that there's a lot of backstories to some of the details in the book, but. I'm wondering, before jumping into the book, if you could both just tell me a little bit about yourselves and your background. And why don't you go first, Anthony?
Thank you. Thank you, Caleb. Well, I am a practicing writer for many, many years and also a trained editor early on. But my editorship on this particular book really needed Michael to actualize it. So I'm a writer, published a dozen books. I seek in these last year, to be of a help wherever I can to writers and Ellen. In fact, that's how really Michael and I met, where he contacted me at a time where I had told him I was in a helping mode. It sounds silly, but that's how it is, because I really feel fortunate and lucky and to have accomplished what I have in a modest way, I think. And so that would define my life, my writing and living life. Yep.
Yeah, I should highlight, just before that, you did send me a few months ago a copy of your Shel Silverstein book, who I think I told you was who I learned to read on. Yeah. So it was very, very nice to receive that. So yeah, you've had a lot of interesting career. Paths leading to this book.
Yep.
And for you, Michael, I'm curious to hear a little about your background and how you got into publishing.
Yeah, I got into it just out of a love of reading and writing, and so I personally consider myself a reader and a writer. Had a chance experience about 10 years ago now to work on a book, to edit it, do developmental edit. Enjoyed it so much, I just started looking to move further into the publishing industry. And so started out freelancing. I'm a lawyer by training. And so I was doing this on the side and ended up going further and connecting with some small presses, working for them, starting to work in acquisitions, just growing in the field, getting, a little bit more responsibility and enjoying it and wanting to go further. And then finally got to, before starting Grayling, kind of the pinnacle of the publishing world for myself and the small niche that I was in, of just sort of getting really close to a publisher and just seeing the 30,000 foot picture of everything, not just the editorial side, but the business side, the art side, everything that goes into kind of making the book. After a stint there, I kind of realized would be great to kind of be at the helm of a publishing company and scary and great. And so I decided to take all those skills that I'd built up over the years and hopefully put them into action. And that was where Grayling comes from.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the first book for Grailing.
That's correct. This is our first new title we've released, The Great Gatsby, just as a reprint, just kind of as a, calling card of the press. But Anthony's book is our first and our debut title.
And I'm wondering how the two of you met and kind of came together for this project. What was the not necessarily just for this project, but just in general life.
Well, I think Anthony kind of started to allude to it. I had contacted him. As a publisher, was part of Publishers Marketplace and just kind of checking out some of the rights offerings that were up there, seeing if anything, caught my eye. And Anthony had a rights offering up for this book, and it did catch my eye. From what he had put on that, offering, I found out a little bit more about him, saw his website, listened to a few of his interviews, and really, like I said to Anthony, noticed right away that behind that, there was a real artist there, and that Anthony, the way he spoke about his books, the way he spoke about the craft, about literature generally, that, I could tell before even meeting him that that was someone I'd be interested in working with. That was someone who I'd get along with and who I'd kind of, vibe with really well. So that prompted me to reach out, and then Anthony, take it away. I reached out to you and you wrote back.
Flattery will get you everywhere. I mean, so I seriously, I was here I am in a small town coming from Manhattan in my day, and I had received this beautiful letter, really. And it was really beautiful, and it was not only flattering, but it was intelligent. And I had forgotten the rights offering, all the business, and it struck me personally. And I had reached a stage in my life and career where I could really work with or engage people who I respect and like, and that was Michael. And so what happened there was, at that exact point, I was aware that I was taking a risk. And I have lived with risks for many, many decades. So it was really in keeping with the kind of life I've led, and the kind of work I do. And I felt comfortable with engaging Michael that at that point. So that's really how we met at first. And I want to say also that risk that I undertook from my end was well worth it because I engage, I want to say, with an editor who is really, in my estimation, remarkable editor. Michael is an editor that how could I say? I'm also a trained editor, and I was so now I engaged with what I realized of the editorship that I had lost because of my age. I mean age. I mean, well, I had lost some of it, and he compensated and more, and made the book possible.
It's interesting to hear about people and their collaborative efforts, and I think that's a kind of a fascinating way in which you discuss it about this kind of finding someone who is able to kind of pick up some of the skills that you had. You could see it, but still, that kind of almost passing of the baton in a way. It's interesting to hear. I remember when I first was introduced to you, Anthony, Marshall Poe, the founder and editor of the New Books Network, said that Anthony is the type of guy that you would want to give you a tour of New York City. Imagine, like, you've never been to New York before, and you could pick one person to take you around New York and tell you about it. You'd want Anthony to do it. And this book's obviously, it's very much a New York book. I was very caught by the title, Confessions of an Aspiring Pornographer. It's a very, very eye-catching title. And Anthony, I just wonder if you just introduce the book a little bit, talk about some of the inspiration behind it and how you came to write the book.
Okay. Well, I was thinking about this morning, and I would like to say that there were two ideas come to mind immediately is love and well, let's talk about the love. So the way it came about was I was in Florida with my wife caring for her mother and in St. Augustine, Florida, her mother, this person I had grown close to, and we were caring for her. And I was working in the back room, and Ellen was working in the front room. And one morning, out of the blue, Ellen is an academic, a scholar, AAA scholar. She said to me, because she had known some of my past in the publishing industry in the 60s, which was in the paperback industry. It was kind of a paperback company I was working for. It was kind of like a romance, you know, soft core stuff. And I had a job there. It was my first job. And then I didn't say much about it later years, you know. And so that morning she said to me, exact quote, "I'm going to tell you this once. I want a book from you called Confessions of an Aspiring Pornographer," just like that. And it was scary. I was charged. I was dared. I sat back, my eyes open, and I didn't know where that was coming from. And that's perfect with me. That was perfect with me to have, you know, someone I, you know, love address me like that. And I said to myself, "Well, I better do this. Yeah, I mean, I have to do this." And so I sat down that day and started writing this. And it really was the material in the book, his life, Wally's life, and I'm feeling it now, has a ring of truth because of to whom I was writing it. I could not have lied to my wife at that point, you know. It was, you know, too late for me to do that, even that. So I really feel there's an emotional truth. And that fed into the creativity and remembering all these characters, because that job was one of the jobs writers could get if a writer felt that publishing was a way to implement his writing life, you know, which I thought. And I was fortunate, and I was lucky there too, because the copy editor that I trained in was one of the best, you know, in the world. They're gone now. Those men and women, they're just not there anymore. So that's how the book was created, and that's the world that I entered when I wrote it.
Michael, I was wondering if you could talk a little about, you know, some of the things that caught your eye with the book, things that you gravitated towards, maybe some of your favorite aspects of it.
Yeah. First and foremost, just Anthony's writing style. That was, you know, the first thing you can, before you read too far into a book or pick up any plot or any character or any of those elements, you just get the voice. And I could tell right away Anthony was a serious writer. He had a beautiful way of putting it. And it was his own way, and it was nice, and it was straightforward and easy but playful. So that drew me in first, and then I just started, you know, getting further along who he drew out of you know, that voice, the characters he started drawing out, were, you know, the irreverence of them, his interesting digressions. You know, there's an interesting Mussolini subplot. You know, it's just such a playful book, and that was something that we kind of kept at the front of our minds when we were editing. Is if we ever had to make a call or were worrying about going one way or the other, it was always in the direction of being just sort of a little bit more playful with the prose, with the style, a little more open and free going with it, and that. It was fun, you know, maybe that's the answer, that it was just a fun book. You know, it was paced well, making me laugh. And then when it had to get serious, it just cut right to the bone of being serious. And he could do it on a dime. And yeah, those were some of the, you know, instant things that just come out at you from this book once you pick it up.
Anthony, I'm wondering how your writing process has developed over the years. You know, what was the experience writing this book compared to, say, some of your earliest books that you wrote?
I needed an editor. I realized I was losing what, you know, it's hard to say what I was losing. So I needed to work harder. I needed to work in more drafts. This book also made me laugh, you know, and also remembering characters along the way, you know, my publishing. I mean, I was a trained editor, so I remember jobs that I had, you know, forgotten. But so it's an interesting question, Caleb, what what an older writer, more experienced writer, may lose and realize may lose, and then work to recoup, to recuperate, to bring it up to par. I must say, I'm aware of taking on more challenges as I grew older, an older writer, a more experienced writer. Artists often, if you notice, even filmmakers, their projects as they go along are less, how could I say, challenging. I decided to make mine more challenging, and so this was also the structure of this book with the changes, with the with the fantasies and the realities and the shifting was also very challenging, and I took it on. I accepted that, and I think it succeeded, by the way. And I agree with Michael. It was fun. It was fun for me, and it was fun to read. By the way, the production of the book, it's a hardcover now, is really beautiful. I had people commenting recently, Michael and Caleb, how readable it is. That the font is really clear. Really very clear. So I'm proud of it. I'm it's accomplishment. It's an accomplishment I didn't expect, that could be the evolution or some of the changes in my writing.
Anthony, I'd jump in there and say, kind of also going back to what catches your eye about the book and what stands out when you're reading it, it was that bouncing back and forth between this, it's quite an interesting dichotomy. It tells the story of the narrator as a young boy, and say from the ages of 6 to 12, that phase of his life, and then as an adult man in Manhattan in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so it's just quite a contrast in terms of, not quite a Bildungsroman, but you get to see this boy that we have plenty of cutaways to, and his upbringing and his relationship with his mother and the relationship to this, wonderful neighborhood he grew up in Brooklyn. You're kind of treated to seeing the man grow out of that and seeing the person that this character becomes. So it's a pretty fully realized person that you end up spending, a few hundred pages with. And I think, Anthony, something that's interesting, because I think, Caleb, you brought it up. A lot of people, it's one of the first things that jumps out is the title, Confessions of an Aspiring Pornographer. In what sense is it intended? In what sense is it meant? I think is worth talking about, because it's there's a lot to it, more than, kind of at first blush. And Anthony, as you explained it to me, you were talking a lot about that role that you had where you were working for a paperback publisher, and you were generating paperbacks, kind of a writer for hire. I'll let you say more, Anthony, but I remember you phrased it to me as, you meant, or you part of that meaning, however full that meaning is, part of it is this literary pornography, this idea of I'm writing for hire. I'm just someone who's coming in to just do a job, and I'm a, a hired hand. And so I think that fed into the title. But Anthony, I'll give you, say some more. You know it better than I do.
Yeah, no, that was great. That's great. Well, I'm still a writer for hire. I've always been, I'll die hustling. So that's what it was at the time. I mean, that doesn't mean, it's an interesting dichotomy, is that, I was in my 20s when I started working for publishing companies and living in lower Manhattan. And it was a hard life. I mean, as Michael says, this book, reading it over, looking it over, actually, impresses me how much of a whole life it is. It covers his childhood, his parents, how they met. And so I was aware writing it that really this is the first volume. There are more volumes to follow. You may know. So, yeah, I mean, it was, my salary was $94 a week in 1963, working in the publishing company. So it was a struggle. So these were the salad days. And for some writers, I think even Caleb mentioned Shell. So I worked with Shell, and he wrote every day in the cafe, even when he was rich and famous. We are always working. We are always hustling. We are always, how could I say, you know, at least this particular writer. That's true. That's true. It doesn't mean, though, at the same time, see, writers, publishers, and at that time would tell writers what to write. I was known for a writer who would write just what I want. And I'm still, you know, just what I want. And so, you know, that's Valerio. So that's how that is. So, yeah. The writing for hire doesn't mean that I was not enclosed and encased in a project of quality. That happened too. That was going on too. So, I want to read one sentence about what this book is. These confessions, mine, Walter Michael Gregory, center on the interstices between soft and hard literary porn as they were known in the 1960s and 70s. Guardrails are the restraining factors that prevent soft from becoming hard. Only a cock itself knows why it goes soft. Anyway, that's a sentence that I didn't mean to, you know, use the language, but that's really what I was, the world I was treading, the world of between the two, because saying that, that's why that training that I had was great, because you can't get training as a copy editor with Hemingway or Fitzgerald. They bought paperbacks for, you know, there was an agent who hired writers to write these romances, and then my company bought them, and then people like me worked on them. We worked dialogue, we worked the blurbs, we worked pretty much whatever what Michael is doing now. So,
yeah, Michael, it's sort of a great segue actually to the next question that I had was, you know, what was it like for you setting up Grailing and having Confessions as your first publication for the press?
Yeah, it was in many ways easy in the sense that I was so ready to do it. I had been had my eye on having, you know, starting my own small press for a long time. And so when the time finally came to take that step, personally, I just, you know, hit it at 100 miles an hour. And I got it up and running, and, you know, was so excited about that. So I was grateful that I kind of felt comfortable with the skill set of what it takes to, you know, make a book, sell a book, produce a book, all that stuff. And then there's, of course, the tedious, you know, the back end stuff, and the press has to have bank accounts, and it has to have, you know, all these other legal things. But it was, you know, it was fun. This was a passion project that grows out of, just comes from a love of literature. That's what it's, you know, sort of raison d'etre is. It's just, you know, great books and great writing and getting it out there in the world. And so it always felt like doing the right thing and being in the right place. And then as far as finding Anthony and working with Anthony, yeah, I mean, it must have been a twist of fate, because it, you know, Anthony is such a great writer. He has lived such a full, interesting and wonderful literary and New York life. And as you know, that is something that appeals to me. I love New York books. I love literary books, books about writing, you know, a lot of literary fiction, or some of it takes as its subject, you know, the writing process. And that this book does that as well. And so that appeals to me. I grew up right outside Manhattan, so it was familiar territory to me. And like you put it, that's a great way to put it, is that I'd love to have a tour of New York with Anthony. So Anthony, you owe me that, I suppose.
I'll take the two of you. I'll take Marshall too.
Happily.
But yeah, I mean, finding Anthony was sort of miraculous, because there's you know, you just never know who you're going to encounter, and Anthony was the real deal. And you know, we just had so much fun going over and going through this book, and Anthony at every turn just answered whatever challenge I put to him, and the book just kept getting elevated. And so it was a great collaboration, a great person to work with. We there was so much trust. You know, I trusted Anthony and he trusted me in terms of the direction of the book and what was right for the book. We each had a lot of trust in each other to kind of treat and care for and doctor this book up. You know, So that made the process just really, really fun. And it was a great book to start the press off with.
Do you have any advice for writers looking to publish, maybe things that people might not think about, especially advice for, you know, someone who might have a manuscript, but they've never, you know, they haven't submitted anywhere and they're not exactly sure what the process is like in terms of getting it published?
Yes, there are different questions. I think the aesthetic side is one thing. And then the process side is another. On the aesthetic side, my advice is pretty simple. Just make the book amazing and make it very beautiful. And then, you know, you'll be in good shape, which is simple, but not easy. You know, in the process side, as Anthony knows, you know, it takes a while. It takes a while to go from turning in a manuscript to when your book comes out. So hang in there if you're going through that process. And, you know, find someone that you trust, because I certainly felt that trust from Anthony that, you know, it's okay for you, Michael, to work on this book, to make changes on this book. Your opinion is valued and is enhancing the book, and vice versa. Obviously, this is Anthony's book. And so I knew anything I was wondering about or had to, you know, wanted to probe or flesh out a little bit more, just turning it over to Anthony, I knew would be, you know, great, because he'd just come back with something that would completely, you know, hit the mark. And so if you're a writer, you know, maybe find that person, that publisher, that agent, whomever it is that you can work with, where there's that just totally implicit trust going both ways of, you know, you both are going to make this book better and better each time you kind of take a pass at it. And yeah, so it's, you know, I know it can be very challenging. Maybe one more most tactical piece of advice I could have that's really actionable is, it's still pretty old fashioned, but people read query letters and look at them, and, you know, you can tell a lot structure wise, voice wise, aesthetics wise of how this person's going to write just based on something like that or some of the materials they send. And so that matters. Nailing that matters. For me, at least, you know, I can't speak for other publishers, but that's definitely something that is a proxy for whether or not I'd be interested in reaching out to someone.
Yeah, Anthony, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts, general advice.
I do. Work. I never wrote to publish. I still don't, really. I just enjoy the practice. I write every day. I'm like a scribe used to. So you can tell, you know, if you have the calling, you know that you're in it, and it's a passion, and you're in it for life. I mean, and then if you're interested in publishing, when you feel you have a piece to publish, a story, or working on a novel that might have legs and so forth, and you're working every day, and then you could look into sending it out. But the first and foremost thing is to hone the skill to see if you have it. You know, I've had, you know, but right, said, well, I'm going to try it for a year, and then say, no, it doesn't work now. You know, if that's your idea, just forget it and do something else right away. So that would be the advice, you know, to practice and practice and see if you love it and need to do it. Need. That would be some of the advice I would give, you know, from the writer's side, you know, in addition to great advice Michael gave.
Yeah, I'm also wondering, you know, if there's a part of the book for you that was the hardest to write, you know, without spoiling the book. I always find it hard to interview people about fiction because I don't want to spoil the book.
That's a fair question. I think the question, what I remember, the part of the book where the aspiring pornographer is virtually homeless. He's living on the street and at the same time working. And to recollect that period of time is very painful. You know, I really remembered, and then I had to remember, you know, how frightening it was. So I experienced the emotion writing it that I did living it. Living it, you know, I wasn't sleeping on park bench. I mean, I had friends, but I had to really look for a place to stay every night. And that's taxing. And I was lucky. I found the Peacock Cafe. I found two waitresses that helped me. And one, found me a place. And then, and so writing that, I was reliving the emotions of how scary it is in lower Manhattan at 4 o'clock in the morning in 1960. It's a scary thing. So writing that, and I feel that it succeeded. I succeeded, and it's with Michael's help. I succeeded in capturing that time, and I think it would be, frankly, for your listeners interested in reading a book, it's informative not only with the pub how the publishing industry was at that time, but the survival of a writer. I mean, it's a survival story. I mean, it's scary. I mean, what comes out at 2 o'clock in the morning? Because most of the bars, they have 2 o'clock licenses and 4 o'clock licenses. So we would take a tour of Lower Manhattan now. There are bars that have 2 o'clock licenses that we have to leave, and then there are bars that have 4 o'clock licenses. After that, you're on your own, man. Some diners are open 24 hours a day. So there was a diner on Sheridan Square that was open after the bars closed. So all that is, it's a survival story. So it might be interesting to people say at least how this writer is still alive. I mean, literally,
Well,
yeah.
yeah, I was going to say, I think, Anthony, that's what's a part of the beauty of the book is, that theme of taking up writing and what the writing life is and what it means and what it takes. This is someone who endures all that because of how strong the connection to the art is, and who just wants to make, this is a character who just wants to make beautiful writing and writing that is going to be, that's going to matter, that's going to be a real art object. And so he's going through all of that for that, endpoint. And it is a tour of that. It is a tour of, as it says in the book jacket, a sort of a bygone era of Manhattan, of New York City, when books were at the forefront of the culture. Something I pine for is having books back at the forefront of the culture, but that, where someone could introduce a sweeping literary work and it was instantly taken up into the culture, into the popular culture. And so this is a character who's going through that, who's seeing, is tantalized by that prize, that's available. It might not even be available today, but it was certainly available back then. And here's a character who is enduring that privation and that hard writer's life, for beauty, for art. And so it's really, it's wonderful in that sense too.
Anthony, I'm wondering if there's a section of the book that you would like to read, or I could also read along with you if there's dialogue. Michael as well, if you still
You know what I'd like to do while Michael is here, and I know he has to leave soon, is I would like to give an example of the editorship and then what I did. You don't have that. I have, so I, it's from Michael's editing and
Yeah,
my
that sounds great.
rewriting. You give
That's
people an idea.
that's more interesting, honestly.
Well, I didn't mean to, co-opt this, but I have it ready. So here it goes. This is what, and I must say, it wasn't easy for me to accept his suggestions because I had never had that. I have had great editors, in the 60s, 70s, great famous editors, who pretty much left my prose alone. Now here comes this guy who's intruding and writing things in the margin and handwriting. I can't read it and shit. And so, I'm saying, hey, who is it? It wasn't easy to accept it, but I finally did when I realized that he was making it better, when it was in fact better. So here it goes. So in the prose is little Michael. Little Wally finds two books in his room when he's born. They are Ernest Hemingway, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and Beatrix Potter's Tale of Peter Rabbit. So there he is, finding two books. So I started writing about that. And then I'll read what Michael's comment was and then what I did with his comment. Okay. So the prose, original prose is, how did Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls come to be in a kid's room? Maybe an adult had inhabited my room and was intrigued by the books of the great Hemingway before I was born and brought one home. which may explain why I leafed through my Hemingway book every day and sought to understand its presence by the feel of its pages in my hand, along my fingers, against my palm. I ran the backs of my hands over this hardcover book like they were pelt of a rare, beautiful species. Then, this editor, Michael Pieckney, writes, well, in the margin, maybe that got this character Wally started on his literary career. Now, I hadn't thought of that because the fiction was, the writing was that I found the material book and it puzzled me. That's as far as I had gotten. And then he writes this, and then I write, I confess that not knowing but wondering unresolved about my Hemingway book throughout my childhood got this character Wally started on a literary life. The physical book itself, its gray front and back cover, back hardcover with the name Hemingway embossed on the front, its unread pages stitched together. Then I went on to take that book with me out in the world, carried it with me from place to place, from lifetime to lifetime, lover to lover. I kept it with me like it was some irreplaceable heirloom, its physicality to serve as a reminder that a book in itself is a creation. Also to read it one day. In time, the edges of my Hemingway began to fray and its unread pages to turn yellow. Finally, after publishing several books myself, I read it. When I finished and closed it forever, I was able to say to myself, it's good. It's richer by his work.
Well, that's beautiful.
I think so. I think so. So yeah. You say, well, you heard it.
I mean, that's beautiful. It's poetic. It's, you know, it's, it tells an entire story in a few sentences.
And I think it just goes right to the thing we were talking about trust. You know, that's a really, I kind of remember that note, but it's a really short note, you know, just seeing a character who goes on in the book to have a literary life. And okay, here he is presented with, you know, a pretty powerful literary object at a young age where it's completely incomprehensible to him, of course, but just making a slight connection. Maybe that is, you know, maybe that's something that looms over his bookshelf and he kind of, you know, thinks about it. And very brief note. And then look what that, you know, Anthony turned that into. That's the trust. That's, you know, knowing anything the editor is going to give Anthony, he is going to execute on it, you know, in an amazing fashion. And maybe Anthony likewise, that two-way street is him, you know, getting to that point to say, oh, that note, you know, that was interesting. And maybe I'll play around and see what else is there to get out of that. But looking what that brief note got turned into is a testament to Anthony and his writing and his way of seeing and his way of putting it, because it is, you know, it's a really great paragraph that you wrote, that you just read, Anthony. So yeah, all the hard work and all the kudos goes to you on that one.
I just want to, you know, turn it back halfway to you at least. But anyway, it was one sentence that turned into a very rich editing, you know, writing from that sentence. So thank you.
I think that's a great example too. Like, I think oftentimes when people imagine the work of an editor, they imagine it as, you know, fixing, you know. Making passive sentences active, and, you know, fixing spelling errors and things like that, as opposed to a sort of engaged reading where you're really asking questions, but you're doing it in a way that that really can change aspects of the book and can open up avenues that might not have been explored.
I agree.
And yeah. You know, from the publishing perspective, that is, you know, maybe a unique niche that I can occupy or Grayling can occupy. That's what I love first is the editing process. You know, a publisher has to know a lot more than the editing process, and a publishing company has to know more than that. But it is not just slapping a cover on something. You know, for me, it is about finding something that rises to that level of art that Anthony creates at, and getting the chance to play around with it, you know, to investigate it, push and prod it, and see what possibilities are able to come out of. How much further can you extend the art from the book that you have in front of you? And so that's what the press is about. It's definitely about that sort of, you know, in a way, it's a a throwback press. It's like the presses that Anthony probably remembers and rubbed elbows with a lot of the people who were part of those presses. Is just that old bygone era of, you know, this is here for the art of it. And, you know, even in that, and you find writers like Anthony that make that so much easier to pull off because they're true artists. And it just struck me even hearing that, you know, Anthony, how you ended that paragraph with, you could close that Hemingway book and say it was good. And, I think there's so much in that sentence and that phrase, because that is a Hemingway-esque assessment of a, you know, there's probably no more Hemingway-esque adjective than good, that just sweeps over so much and is meant to encompass so much.
I want to just follow up with what Michael just said and talking about, old throwbacks and all that. Michael, I come now to, not to praise Michael's editorship, but what my experience is, I taught a copy editing course at City University in the 70s. Some of the students went on to become, I have to say, professional. But when Michael's skill is, it's really rare. It really is. And I have never seen it, because I've had like great editors, but I have never needed the extent that his editorship took. So I would say it's really a gift, and a gift I appreciate. I really appreciate it.
No, it's really great to hear, and it's amazing to hear that people that you're able to have this experience with an editor, of this sort of caliber, and get that sort of that first reader who's really, and I'm sure he wasn't your first reader of this book, but to get that reader before publication who's going to really dig in and give you the type of feedback that's going to help prompt you and help expand and deepen the book that you're writing. So I'm wondering, for those that are interested in picking up the book, where can they find it? Is there a good place that they can go and get a copy?
Michael?
Yeah, it is on Amazon. It is also for sale on the Grayling Press website, which you might enjoy because there's some other stuff there to check out. But graylingpress.com is where you can buy Anthony's book in hardcover.
Wonderful. Yeah, I definitely recommend people go and do that and support a small new press. Always good. I definitely recommend going to Grayling. Go directly to Grayling. That other site, it's useful sometimes. Won't say too much about why. But, Michael and Anthony, thank you so much for being guests on the New Books Network. Anthony, it was so great to speak with you again. And Michael, thank you for being on the program. Always great to talk to interesting people doing interesting things in publishing and, proving that there still is innovation in this field. It really is wonderful. And, the book Confessions of an Aspiring Pornographer, the first book for Ungrailing. So definitely check it out and see what else they have coming out in the future. So thank you both so much.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's great talk. Good to see you, Anthony.